This is the BBC.
Welcome to the Week in Westminster podcast with me, Tom Newton-Dunn from The Sun. Another day, another crisis, rang out the Daily Telegraph's page one headline on Thursday morning, summing up what was truly a weekus horribilis for Theresa May in Westminster this week. First, there was Priti Patel. As Shadow Cabinet Office Minister John Trickett explained it,
she's had a series of meetings kept secret from the Prime Minister, not told the full picture when she's met the Prime Minister, and then she's asked the department to effectively explore giving our money to the Israeli army. I mean, it's extraordinary. And the Prime Minister found out about it by listening to the radio.
Too extraordinary, it proved, for her cabinet career to continue. The International Development Secretary flew 5,000 miles back from Kenya to resign before she was sacked, 6 days, 23 and a half hours after Defence Secretary Sir Michael Fallon also had to go for inappropriate behaviour towards women. Simultaneously, the PM was forced to defend why she was keeping Boris Johnson in his job after his very unfortunate gaffe about a British mum jailed in Iran.
I'm sorry if any words of mine have been so taken out of context and so misconstrued as to cause any kind of anxiety for the family of Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe. Of course I am. Of course I am.
A classic in the genre of almost apology. And all of this while a Cabinet Office inquiry continues into sleaze allegations levied against Trade Minister Mark Garnier, and even more worryingly for the PM, her very own de facto deputy, First Secretary Damien Green. And that's not to mention a sixth round of Brexit talks, where little obvious progress was made on Friday, and growing rancour between Number 10 and Number 11 over the Chancellor's make-or-break budget in just 11 days' time. The opposition scented multiple trails of blood. Labour MP Pat McFadden drew an ominous conclusion.
There are times when a government has the stench of death about it.
They are leaderless,
directionless, and we learn today that their defence is that they are also contentless.
Perhaps inevitably, comparisons began to be drawn between Theresa May's administration and the dying days of John Major's in the 1990s. Will she be another Tory Prime Minister sunk under the impossible weight of sleaze and vicious splits of the European Union? Two veterans of John Major's government came into the studio. His former Defence Secretary and one of his three famous EU bastards, Michael Portillo, and the former PM's press secretary at the time, Sir Christopher Mayer. I asked Michael Portillo whether Mrs May has just been the victim of a catastrophic run of bad luck, or is there a theme that connects up all the mess?
Well, there's an underlying theme, which is the relationship between the Conservative Party and Europe. I remember John Major, when he was Chief Secretary of the Treasury, telling me that Europe was a wolf coming up the path to gobble up the Conservative Party in 1987. I didn't entirely understand the remark at the time, but the meaning has become entirely evident to me since. The Conservative Party is torn apart by this issue. And so it was during the Major government, of which I was a member, that we were divided. The issue then was whether we should commit to joining the euro or not. And we divided along the two sides, and we found ourselves with a Prime Minister who kind of bounced between the two, sometimes, I think, pretending to Eurosceptics to be a Eurosceptic, and on the whole, pretending to Europhiles to be a Europhile.
That feels quite familiar.
Well, it established, I think, a certain instability, because it was as though we were leaping from either side of the boat. I felt that it was quite helpful to John Major to emphasise some Eurosceptic views, and others felt that it was helpful to emphasise their Europhile views, and so the boat, you know, more and more rocked from side to side.
Is Theresa May, therefore, today's John Major? Is she in office but not in power?
Yes, I think that is broadly the case, but I'm afraid I think her position is worse in a number of important ways. First of all, the cabinet of which I was a member had some huge beasts in it. I mean, Kenneth Clark and Michael Heseltine, some of the greatest talents in politics of the 20th century. Secondly, we were not wrestling with anything as big as Brexit. And thirdly, the alternative to us was Tony Blair and New Labour. And the world was not in fear of Tony Blair and New Labour. In fact, they were rather looking forward to it. I mean, markets weren't going to tumble if Tony Blair came to office. So I think now the fact that Brexit is so important, that the cabinet seems rather short of big beasts, and that the prospect of a Corbyn government certainly strikes fear into industry in the city, just to name those two, I think the situation is now worse.
Christopher, you were obviously there too at the same time. Better or worse than John Major's years?
Well, there are similarities, but the situation today compared with that of John Major hasn't sufficiently evolved to be able to say this is worse or this is better. Our ejection from the exchange rate mechanism, the ERM, was, if you like, the equivalent of Theresa May's disastrous General Election call, which completely has undermined her authority, her morale. The thing I would add to Europe, in the end, the fact that the Europhobes and the Europhiles in the Tory party at the time of John Major were almost equally balanced meant that it underwrote John Major's longevity as a prime minister because nobody could agree on who should succeed him. Now, it is possible that there is a similar standoff between Remainers and Leavers in the cabinet and in the Tory party such that, despite Theresa May's weakness today, she too will find that underwrites a certain longevity that takes her at least until the end of the Brexit negotiation. The other additional similarity is sex. Because when I arrived in Downing Street in early 1994 to become press secretary to replace Gus O'Donnell, Back to Basics had suddenly raced out of control. It exploded out of control. Because in a throwaway line, I think at a joint press event with Albert Reynolds, then Taoiseach of Republic of Ireland, outside Downing Street, there was the killer, as ever, throwaway final question from the hacks standing out there in Downing Street. And they suddenly shouted at Major, "Does Back to Basics cover personal behaviour or personal morality?" It was something like that. And Major said, "Yes," and turned on his heel and walked into Downing Street. Well, after that, every single Tory politician on whom the newspapers had a little bit of dirt found themselves in the firing line.
It was open season.
Yeah, so every Saturday afternoon, sometime between 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock, my phone would go. Usually it was the News of the World, not invariably. And they'd say, "We've got a story about, Sir somebody or Mr. somebody who has been seen in the back of a cab somewhere up in North London snogging. What do you say to that?" We had weeks, months of these sex eruptions. Now, we've had something similar as a background to Tory and Labour disorder in the last few weeks, except that these have all been, I think, far more serious.
But if you're in the press office like that, fighting fires day upon day upon day, as you were, as Theresa May now is, what's it actually like? I mean, is it a bunker mentality? Do you feel permanently under siege? And of course, you have people like Michael Portillo at the time, famously known as a bastard, the enemy within.
Yeah, and this Portillo guy, he was a really, really dangerous character. I mean, because he was in the cabinet, had a senior position as the Secretary of State, firstly employment and then defence. So you had to watch everything he said and did.
Well, thank you for building my reputation. I think the comparison with John Major is that, for the moment at least, she's probably even more secured in her position than John Major was on the faute de mieux principle, on the principle that it's difficult to find anybody better. I mean, the one thing you would ask yourself is, whether she can put up with this, because this must be an extremely miserable and lonely existence.
It drove John Major crazy as well. He found blessed relief in going to Ulster, to leave Westminster behind and go to Ulster. And when he started going to Ulster in 94, it was dangerous. We had to go everywhere by helicopter, went nowhere by road. And he didn't care about the physical danger of operating in Northern Ireland because it was better for him, more satisfying for him than the hell, as he saw it, of the Westminster bubble.
And the peace process is a great monument, great legacy of his.
Chris Patton, another of your vintage, now Lord Patton, a minister under John Major until he lost his seat in 1992, said this week that when a prime minister loses the ability to put the fear of God into people, they're in real trouble. And that's also what's been suggested about Theresa May. People simply aren't scared of her anymore. And that potentially is one explanation why you have Priti Patel freelancing on Israeli policy, Boris Johnson simply not reading his brief on Iranian prisoners. Is that a potential explanation?
Often agree with Chris, but he's absolutely right about this. When I used to go and see Margaret Thatcher, I spent hours of fevered preparation. And despite however much preparation you did, you never had the answers that the Prime Minister wanted. She always lost her temper with you and thought that you were inadequately prepared. But I'm afraid with John Major, I would saunter along after a good lunch. It was an entirely different feeling.
No wonder we called you that horrible word.
Well, it's not entirely clear whether he did, but let that pass. But, I mean, going to see Margaret Thatcher was like going to the headmistress's study, the headmaster's study. I was trembling from head to foot. It was not like that when I went to John Major. I don't suppose it's like that when you go to see Mrs. May. And I do think Priti Patel, I'm a great admirer of hers. I mean, she's been trying to run an independent foreign policy. I mean, that is an extraordinary thing to believe that you might get away with. So that says something about the regime.
Christopher, how does Theresa May now put the fear of God back into people if that's the only way you really can be a good PM?
Well, by almost making every decision a sack me or back me moment until she actually starts to stabilise. The key thing for her is to behave as if she is in a very strong position. And then it puts the onus on everybody else to say, well, we're not going to do that, which then leads to a general election and Corbyn becomes prime minister. That, I think, is the only strategy that is available to her.
The one thing that she can rely on, given the strength of the Labour Party, its position in the opinion polls, is that whenever it comes to a vote of confidence, her members of parliament are going to vote solidly for the government in the vote of confidence. And I would think the United Ulster Unionists as well. I think Christopher is right. She can play it to the wire on a number of occasions with some effect.
Michael Portillo and Sir Christopher Mayer on Theresa's cabinet travails. The sexual harassment scandal took a tragic turn this week. Former Welsh Government Minister Carl Sargent was found dead at his home 4 days after he was sacked and suspended from the Welsh Labour Party when claims emerged that he'd carried out inappropriate touching or groping. So has it all gone too far? More than a few MPs now think exactly that and bitterly complain this week of a trial by media. One of those is former Army officer Bob Stewart. His name was on a list of 44 Tory MPs drawn up by Commons researchers alleging various forms of impropriety. I asked Bob Stewart what it felt like to discover he was one of the accused.
Well, firstly, I was actually horrified and then angry because on both counts that I was apparently drinking too much. I haven't been drunk in Parliament. I haven't really been drunk since I left the army, and that's 25 years ago. As for alleged misconduct with women, I presume this comes from me referring to a girl by the word Totty some time ago. I apologise, I didn't mean to offend anyone, and I'm never rude to a woman, and I've never done anything like I'm alleged to do. So I get angry with this because actually I've got children who go to school who hear this rubbish put out about their father. And, you know, my wife totally understands it's rubbish, but the arrow does get through.
We had the tragic case of Carl Sargent's death this week. Mm. That's led some to say this firestorm has gone too far. People's lives now at risk, people's lives now being lost.
Absolutely, but the point is, if you're a politician, it seems the rules don't apply to you, to the rest of society. We are apparently adjudged guilty and we don't have the chance to prove our innocence. Even when it's palpable rubbish and everyone knows it, some people will still write emails to me, for example, being extremely rude with absolutely no evidence whatsoever. The answer, I suppose, is you could take these people to court. You can take newspapers to court that make these accusations. After all, they're totally unsubstantiated. But people like myself, the majority of MPs, don't have that sort of money to start hiring barristers.
The thing is that some of these allegations have, of course, been substantiated. Some very senior people have lost their jobs and been forced to resign over it. So newspapers have done some right here, haven't they?
Yeah. The trouble is we're all tarred with the same brush, and we shouldn't be. And whoever's made these accusations is anonymous and doesn't provide any information. Why the heck should people make accusations like that against someone like myself? And a lot of other people, by the way.
Did your family ask you slightly uncomfortable questions as a result of your name?
No, in fairness, my children did not, because they know it's rubbish. But it doesn't stop people at school making comments, I'm sure.
That's what happened, was it?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens.
In the playground or...?
Wherever, on social media, whatever. I'm a politician, I suppose I'm used to that sort of thing. But when your family get involved, to me, I think that's offside.
Where should we then draw the line on acceptability as it refers to conduct between MPs, women, men of a sexual nature, a flirting nature? Where is the line for you?
I don't know, to be honest. I don't know how you...
But shouldn't you know? I mean, isn't that a problem?
I mean, the point is I know what's right and I know what's wrong. These days, you can't say anything without possibly being accused. I mean, I have actually said something like, you look really, really lovely today in your outfit. And I've been told that's inappropriate language. Well, I mean, goodness sake, my wife's beside me. You know, I'm saying it. What am I... Where do we go? How do we do it? I know what is right and I know what is wrong. And most people and most women know what is right and what is wrong. And they know when someone's trying it on.
Some say that the whole business of flirtation and perhaps light-hearted banter of this nature in the workplace, in a place as serious as the House of Commons, should stop altogether. Do you agree?
Well, we're going to stop human relationships. Most people tend to find their partners at work or, you know, when they're at a party which might be connected to work. I mean, that's why the difficulty of actually laying down rules on this sort of thing.
Was it right to say to a female journalist, I want to talk to the Tossie? I don't think your wife was
not
there
now
when you said that.
I made a mistake because she took offence at that. I didn't mean it to be offensive.
Do you accept that you can't use words like Tottie anymore? I mean, that, of course, is the accusation.
Yeah, I've learnt that is true. But it wasn't meant to be rude. You know, most people understand that. I am not rude to women. I'm not rude to men either, for that matter.
The Conservative MP, Bob Stewart. Meanwhile, Theresa May met Westminster's party leaders on Monday night to try to thrash out a solution to the sex scandal. They proposed a grievance process independent of all MPs so victims can come forward and have any complaint taken seriously and investigated. One who was present in the Prime Minister's House of Commons study was Caroline Lucas, co-leader of the Green Party. Along with other leading MPs, she thinks there is still very much a case to answer. I began by asking how the leaders' meeting went.
Well, I think it was a constructive meeting. I was personally heartened by the sense of urgency around the table, and there seemed to be a real recognition that we need to put in place much more effective structures as soon as possible. Everybody agreed about the need for an independent grievance process which covers all staff. I was keen to make sure that that included, for example, cleaners whose contracts are outsourced, so it absolutely is all staff on the parliamentary estate and in the constituency offices. I was pleased that my proposal for training was taken up, but I think the challenge now is to make sure that covers not just management, but also, crucially, consent as well, because I think if the last few weeks have shown us anything, it's that some MPs simply extraordinarily don't seem to know what consent means. And when you've got Michael Fallon saying that what he did was fine 10 or 15 years ago, then, you know, I think that does reveal the fact that he needs to know that it absolutely wasn't fine 10 or 15 years ago and it isn't fine now.
It must have been a slightly odd atmosphere, wasn't it, with you, Theresa May, Vince Cable, Jeremy Corbyn, and you're normally all at each other's throats.
No, I genuinely think for this occasion, and you know, if it changes, I'll certainly call it out. But on this occasion, I think there was a general recognition that this is above party politics. This isn't about individual parties. This is about individual lives being absolutely damaged, harmed, wrecked. And it's about the reputation of Parliament. And I do think all of us around the table shared that sense that we urgently need to do something pretty dramatic. I would like us as well, for example, to be looking at how MPs actually employ their staff. I still think there's a problem there when you've got 650 different employment structures. I didn't win that at the meeting. There will be a working group set up. I hope to still push that point there.
We had the tragic case of Carl Sargent's death this week, which is, I think, has prompted, perhaps quite rightly, some serious thinking now of has this entire firestorm gone too far over sexual allegations, accusations of trial by media, although the media didn't actually break the Carl Sargent story. The first we heard of it was when he was suspended. What are your thoughts?
Well, clearly the Carl Sargent incident was absolutely tragic, heartbreaking. I don't know the details of it, but it seems to me that an independent grievance process would be the best way of protecting everybody involved, both those who have had allegations made against them, rightly or wrongly, you know, we don't know. But in order to protect both the people who are making the allegations and those who have allegations made against them, it seems to me that that independent grievance process with expert help, you know, we need people who are well trained in how to deal with these issues. That's what we need to protect everybody. And I think the tragedy around Carl Sargent simply highlights that.
Where, in your view, should we be drawing the line on what is acceptable behaviour then? You just talked about Michael Fallon, but what is acceptable, what should be a newspaper story, and what really should be something we shouldn't be caring about? Where is the line for you?
I certainly think that as well as tackling all of the legal structures here, we need to be tackling the broader culture at Westminster, because I think it is absolutely unacceptable that the kind of behaviour that goes on there, and I'm talking about a clear spectrum. You know, at one end of the spectrum, there are allegations of sexual assault, which absolutely have to go through the courts. They are legal issues. But right at the other end of the spectrum, there's this whole atmosphere of the Old Boys Club at Westminster, where the kind of behaviour at PMQs and elsewhere simply would not be acceptable in any other workplace. And it does trouble me that Westminster really ought to be the beacon of best practice, whereas right now it seems to be one of the worst.
Some MPs, Tory MPs perhaps, have bemoaned that the firestorm and some of the suggestions that you're making as the end of flirtation and banter per se.
I don't think flirtation and banter per se is appropriate in a workplace. You know, it just is not. And if any of those people have been on the receiving end of it and know how uncomfortable it makes some people feel, they might recognise that. A workplace is somewhere where you come to do your work. What you do outside of that is absolutely your own business and their business and so forth.
So you can't
but we have
go
to
out
have
with a
safe...
work colleague any longer.
I'm talking about what's happening within the context of when you are at work. When you are at work, you should be in a professional setting where you are not worrying about whether or not someone is trying to make a pass at you or whether or not they are making comments about what you're wearing and how you're acting in a very public way. You know, this isn't rocket science. It really is not. People need to know what's acceptable and what isn't. I think some training would not go amiss.
Some MPs' language has also been called into question. Words like totty to talk about women, you would obviously view that as unacceptable now.
I would, and I think most people listening would. I mean, I just find it quite odd that we're having this conversation in the 21st century. You know, can we not just please have men and women working alongside one another as equals? It doesn't seem that much to ask.
Caroline Lucas on how Westminster should speak and behave. Finally this week, it would seem appropriate to mark Armistice Day today by noting a quite intriguing trend in politics on both sides of the Atlantic, the rise of the military man and woman. Donald Trump's White House is now run by them, with the President's Chief of Staff, National Security Advisor and Defence Secretary, all former generals. And on this side of the pond, no less than five young, thrusting MPs who have spent time in uniform are now being talked up as future party leaders. One of them, Royal Navy Reservist Penny Mordaunt, took a big step closer to number 10 herself, with her promotion into the cabinet on Thursday, taking up Priti Patel's place. So what's going on? I asked two honourable and gallant members of Parliament, as they should properly be addressed in the Commons Chamber, to give me their views. Former Parachute Regiment officer Dan Jarvis, tipped as a future Labour leader, and Rifles Regiment former Major and Conservative MP James Heapy. Dan Jarvis first.
I think it's a general point about the esteem and the respect in which the public hold people who have served. Not just talking about people who've been in the military, I'm thinking of doctors and nurses and teachers. And I think what people who have that kind of professional credibility bring is the ability to get things done. And we need in politics people who've got real life experience, people know how to achieve things that are difficult to do. I think, interestingly, there's a cultural difference between Britain and the States. I think there is much more of a reverence in America to those people who are veterans, who've served their country. We don't have it in quite the same way here. But I think there is a kind of general acknowledgement that Parliament is enriched by people who know what it's like to do something difficult, who have real professional experience.
Does trust come into this? I mean, we all know, and you'll both accept, that trust in today's politics and today's politicians is at an all-time low. If the public see their potential leaders as people motivated by public service, to the point that they put their lives on the line in service of their country, does that help them to win trust better than perhaps civilians?
I think that trust is the defining word in our politics at the moment. I don't know what James thinks, but I think it's a very interesting and quite a complex transition to move from an organisation like the army, where people work seamlessly together as part of a team, and come into the House of Commons, where the reality is, sadly, that there isn't that same sense of camaraderie, that there isn't that same collegiate spirit that you get in the military. And, you know, one of the things that I hope that we can all do is try and improve upon that, to work collectively across the House to get things done and to serve the public.
JCP.
I think Dan makes exactly the right point. We were both in infantry regiments and served in some very dangerous places in very difficult circumstances. And the whole ideology, I guess, is that you look down and you look after your blokes and you rely on those above you to be looking down and looking after you. And that is completely at odds with how you have to be if you want to catch the selector's eye in Westminster. You know, the people who get ahead quickly here are those who are sort of looking up, waving, saying, hey, everybody, hey, political editor of the Sun, look at me. I'm not sure that I want to entirely make the transition, to be honest, because I think the military mantra probably is a better way of serving. But still, it's certainly a very different culture to being in an infantry regiment where you would find yourself in the colonel's office quite quickly if you were too often looking up and making sure your hard work was being noticed.
James, the rise of the military man, the White House is full of them at the moment. Donald Trump's cabinet has a fair few of them. And here, at least four MPs that I can think of have been tipped as future prime ministers who have done military service and only been elected, in some of them, in the last few years. Why is that? Is there a theme?
I'm not sure if there's a definite theme beyond maybe the prominence of Iraq and Afghanistan and therefore military service in the minds of the public might mean that those of us who have served currently capture the public's imagination in a way that maybe ex-military people hadn't since the Falklands, perhaps.
Well, that you have three Tory colleagues oft talked about as future PMs, Tom Tugendhat, James Cleverly and Johnny Mercer. Could you see any of those three in the top job?
I think that all three of them are very talented people.
What a political answer. You've obviously left the military a while back. Dan Jarvis, same question to you. Which of those three is going to be PM?
I can see one of them being PM, but I don't think I'd be doing them any favours if I said which one.
Dan Jarvis and James Heapy on how the future just could be military. That's it from me. Only the small matter of pushing the EU withdrawal bill through the Commons for the Prime Minister next week. The FT's George Parker will be here next Saturday to take you through that.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.